Welcome to Table Topics, the general advice and discussion podcast from the RPG Academy. I am Michael, and this is Table Topics episode number 59, Dragonline. In this week's episode, Caleb and I had the pleasure of sitting down with C.B. Droege, who is a professor here in the Cincinnati area. He is a novelist, he is a poet, he is also a Kickstarter-er, and he's also a game designer. And we discuss kind of his process for creating games, where the idea for the setting came from, some wins and loses, I guess, from Kickstarter, like, you know, advice for what he would do differently. And then we talk a lot about the game that he created from the setting that he wrote called Dragonline. And it sounds like it's a very interesting game. I have not had a chance to play it. He did provide me with a print-and-play version, but I haven't had a chance to do that. But I've read through the rules. It sounds really interesting, and I'm actually looking forward to playing it. And CB may even stop by for a Catacon in November and do a demo of his game. So if you're coming to a Catacon, there's a good chance you'll get to run into him. I do want to note there was a slight bit of an audio issue. For some reason, his audio coming in was just a little bit off compared to Caleb's. And I did what I could to edit it and make it a little bit clearer, but I don't know that I did enough, so please forgive that. And we'll move on with the show. But before we do that, I do want to give a quick shout out to our newest patron, Jeremy. He spelled his name for me phonetically, and I'm still not going to try it because I'm awful at that. I don't want to insult you. So Jeremy, thank you so much for becoming a patron of the RPG Academy. We really appreciate you just listening. But on top of that, you're offering some money to help us do some cool, cool things in the future with our show. If anyone else out there is interested in becoming a patron of our show, go to patreon.com/the RPG Academy. You can pledge for as little as $1 a month, and there's some cool rewards that come. The more that you pledge, the cooler the rewards get. At least that's the theory, anyways. So anyways, on to the show. Here is Table Topics episode number 59, Dragonline. Alright guys, well welcome to Table Topics. I am your host Michael, and I have brought along with me, as I usually do, your favorite co-host and mine, Caleb G. And tonight we have a special guest joining us, CB, who is a professor here in Cincinnati or in the area. He is an author, a poet, a game designer, and a successful Kickstarter-er. CB, welcome to the show, and if you don't mind, please introduce yourself to our audience.
Thank you. Yes, I am, you said, CB Droege. I am a novelist, science fiction and fantasy, as well as a professor. I teach at Galen, is the name of the college. I also teach at Southern State Community College, teaching writing and English classes, grammar and literature and stuff like that. As a writer, I spend a lot of time as a journalist, doing sort of geek culture journalism stuff. Across a few different magazines, I wrote as many as 2,000 articles about all kinds of different topics, from D&D stuff to, you know, deep television shows. I wrote a lot about Game of Thrones and Star Trek and comic books as well, and video games. So I had kind of a wide spectrum of what we sort of call geek interests that I wrote about for a few different magazines. Did that for a while, got out of that a couple of years ago for a few different reasons, one of which was to focus more on my novels and game design projects, but also because online journalism isn't what it once was. I'm sort of moving away from some of the things that it seemed to be starting to take to be a successful online journalist were not within the realm of good taste for me. So started moving away from some of that stuff, a lot of that. The job offers I got after the magazines I was working for started to close down were not with companies that I would think of as, you know, reputable journalism factions. So I'll leave that at that.
Okay.
But I did, right about that same time, my first novel was published. Zeta Disconnect is a time travel adventure story that I had written. It was actually a novel that was a very long time in the making. It started out as a series of short stories years and years ago that got put together into a novel with some sort of meat added in between them to turn it into a longer story. and got picked up just a few years ago. And so now that's out, and that's what I take that to show to, as well as a bunch of short stories. And as you mentioned, I've got my poetry out there. And so I try to, you know, kind of spread myself wide as a writer. For a long time, tabletop role-playing gaming had been simply a hobby. I had gotten into it as a kid. I played, you know, AD&D and A2. I had designed my own sort of role-playing systems, did some like weird experimental stuff. I never really thought of it as something that I would do as part of my writing career until I started to see, it was really, partly it was Kickstarter that convinced me into it. So I started to see other similar projects, but they're nothing exactly like mine, come into and out of Kickstarter. And the thing that had sort of held me back, like when I ever thought of, oh, maybe I should do maybe some D&D books, that would be cool. But it was the art that always held me back, because I'm not a visual artist. That's not in the way that I would need to be to do D&D books. There's a lot of monsters and figures and swords and things like that. And I would have to pay those artists, right? So I didn't have the funds to do even sort of an independent project that way. But when I saw how Kickstarter was working, I thought, well, I'll just give it a shot. Honestly, probably shouldn't admit this, but I wasn't really expecting it to succeed. In some ways, starting the Kickstarter for me and putting the work into describing it and trying to get people to fund it for me and getting the artists on board and all that stuff was a way for me to watch that part of who I am sort of fail and let me concentrate on other things so that I could stop thinking, oh, maybe I should do a D&D book. And I could be like, no, that failed. I'm not going to do that anymore. And it succeeded, so I did it. that was a surprise to me, as much as it may have been to anyone else. Though the ironic thing about the Kickstarter, I mean, first of all, you know, if you know anything about Kickstarter, you're required to make a lot of estimations right off the bat, how much money it's going to take, how much time it's going to take, how many people are going to be involved, and all these kinds of things. And I am not, you know, a business person, and I was wildly wrong on lots of things. The time I had estimated that it would take, because I had most of the material already, that it would only take like 5 months to get everything illustrated and a book in people's hands, and it took almost a year and a half. And I thought I could do the whole thing for about $1,500, which is what I set the Kickstarter at a relative what seems now like a very low number, because it took many times that to actually get the book out, and illustrated and printed and everything that I needed to do. So it was actually a really fortuitous thing that the Kickstarter ended up finishing a lot higher than what I had said I needed, because I actually needed a lot more and didn't end up coming out of the Kickstarter itself with, you know, profit, as it were. But right. What I did have then is a finished book that I could print more of and take to shows and show to people. But the thing that was sort of ironic about it is that was Dragonline. Dragonline is the card game that's based loosely on the lore. I'll explain that in a second. But based loosely on the lore of the Isles of the Sun campaign setting, and it was a stretch goal, is what they call it in Kickstarter parlance, where right. If we reach a certain amount of dollars over what I had anticipated needing, then I'll do this like extra thing. And so the Dragonline card game, physical version of the in-game card game, was my $4,500 stretch goal. And I hit exactly $4,500 right at the last second. And then I had to do Dragonline. And at first I was kind of like, oh, great, now I have to do this extra thing. But I don't even know what I'm going to do with it. Like, I hadn't even thought about what Dragonline was going to be. But Dragonline itself, now that it's done and it's out and I'm taking it to shows and I'm demonstrating it to people, it has turned out to be way more popular than anything else that I bring with me to the like Comic Cons and gaming shows and things like that. Everybody who sits down to play Dragonline falls in love with it and wants copies of it. And it's sort of a niche game because it's a tactical game, a very tactical game for two people. It's incredibly well balanced. Like my goal for it was to make a game that was super balanced, like it focused on balance really heavily. And there just aren't many balanced tactical two-player games out there, especially not quick ones. And so that this game, it only takes 10 to 20 minutes to play, and that only two people, you can't even have more players than that. So I end up having a lot of people, I'll have like couples come by, you know, gaming couples come by and sit down, and they'll say, this is amazing, we don't have any games on our shelf, but the two of us can just sit down and play in 10 minutes, and it's not just like a dice roll, it's actually tactical.
Right.
So that's been like a really popular niche that I sort of dropped this game into, and has worked out really well.
All right, so we covered a lot of ground already. There's a lot of questions that I want to kind of go back and hit on, because I think there's some really interesting stuff in there. First thing I want to talk about, if you don't mind, is the Kickstarter, because I know that's kind of, especially with RPGs, that's sort of the thing now. Everybody and their brother is launching Kickstarters, and I think much like what you had, some people are maybe even surprised by their success, and maybe overpromise and make it difficult to deliver. Now, your Kickstarter was in 2013, correct?
Something like that.
Somewhere in there. So you kind of hinted on it, but one, are you interested in doing another Kickstarter? And if so, would you give any advice to someone other than your estimations might have been off? Is there anything else about just how you publicized it, how you got the word out, anything that you would want to do differently on a future Kickstarter?
Well, I mean, yeah, you already mentioned the big thing is the estimates, right? The major thing that I feel like I did wrong was not knowing how much money or time I actually needed. And I was also very surprised by, and this is part of the time thing, I was surprised by how difficult it was for me to manage the people I was hiring. So, you know, I was imagining in my mind, okay, well, I need people to do illustrations for my book. I'll get a team of like six artists, and I'm going to be paying them per illustration, so I can set deadlines for them and, you know, give them their assignments, and I'll get them done, and I'll give them to me. And when the Kickstarter ended, 2 months later, I had my team of artists, and I had given them all assignments, and all of their, like, their first assignments were due, and none of them had been typed. And that was sort of the trend for the next year and a half, is me sort of riding and whipping these artists who I was, you know, paying. They weren't like volunteers, they weren't just friends who had been working. These were people, you know, professional illustrators that I had found and had hired to illustrate for me, and it turned out to be really hard to actually get them to work, which, you know, I understand, and especially looking back, I feel like, well, I probably should have anticipated that. Artists, I'm an artist, I'm a fickle person. When I'm given deadlines, it's, you know, hard for me to meet them. So I should have sort of anticipated a little bit of that, but I thought I had in giving 5 months instead of like 3 months.
Right.
So I was way off on that stuff. So if you have, I guess the advice that would come out of that is that if you need to hire other people to do the work, keep in mind that they are not always going to have the same expectations of time and priority that you have on the project, especially if you can't hire them full time.
So where did you find your artists? Were these people that you just liked their art and you approached them? Like how did you actually go about doing that?
Some of it was, I had sort of three steps. First, I asked my friends. As a writer, I have a lot of writer and artist friends. And so I sort of just put out a call on Facebook. And I got a couple of people that way. And then I went through and started just like looking at deviant art fantasy illustrators.
Okay.
And just literally, you know, cold calling them, sending them an email and saying, hey, I need some illustrators. That didn't work at all. Everyone responded really badly to that. What worked a little bit better was going on to the deviant art forums. They have like a discussion board. And
okay.
There's actually a specific discussion board just for, I need to hire some writers. Here's my project, and here's how, or I need to hire some artists. Here's my project, and here's how much I'm paying. Who wants to do it? And so when I went on there and gave a description of the project, and what kind of art I needed, and how much I was paying, then I got a flood of emails, and I got to take my sort of pick of the best of hundreds of people that emailed me with wanting to do my project. So that turned out to be the really good way to find artists. But it still didn't turn out to be a good way to find artists who'd actually meet deadlines and, you know, do all the things that they said they were going to do. Just because they are so, you know, every person who was on the project was a person who also worked in a coffee shop or, you know, an IT firm or whatever. You know, they had their day job, and this was a thing they did in the evening for a little extra money, and that, I guess, makes it hard to really do it, right? So that was the biggest surprise to me, and that was the thing that added so much to the time that the project took.
Okay, I think it's, you know, obviously with your background as a writer, I think from my limited experience with Kickstarter, because, you know, I'm fairly new to that. I haven't done one myself. Caleb and I have discussed the possibility of us trying to create some content, maybe going that route. So it's something we're kind of playing around with. But I think for many people, the actual writing of content might be one of the most challenging things. But mm-hmm. for you, that probably was one of the easiest.
Oh, well, yeah. In fact, with Idols of the Sun, my side of the content was basically done. I had to format it to fit into a book. Like, I put it into the standard format with, like, the two columns and the headings and separated it into, like, here's the monsters and here's the items and stuff like that, because it was just on my DM's notes. I mean, this was a campaign that I designed to run for friends. This campaign setting was the culmination of 20 years of experimentation and building, like, history crafting and world crafting, character crafting, all of this stuff going into the setting that's called Dark World, which has several eras that stories take place in. The Sun Era is the one that the Isles of the Sun describes. And it had many forms and different eras and different stories before that. But all of these notes sort of collected together, and I just finished when I thought to start the Kickstarter campaign. I just finished running a 4.5 year campaign in the setting as the DM, and so I had, like, everything. And the original plan actually was to do the campaign, not the setting, because I had gotten a lot of comments that the story that I had done that time was really good. But in order to get the story out, in order to do the campaign, the world needed to be understood. And when I started looking at just how much information was there for the setting itself, I realized that was a separate book, and it needed to come first. So the campaign never even actually made it into print yet, because I just did the setting. And that has all the, you know, the races and the monsters and items and the maps and everything that goes along with this place where we played. And it has a lot of the sort of hooks that became the campaign that I had run for those players, the different areas of the world that are in conflict, that need heroes and so forth. But the campaign, the story itself, is not in the book. And that's what, if I did another Kickstarter, that's sort of what I would want it to be, is the next Isles of the Sun book, which would be the first chapter or first segment of the greater campaign, which is designed to be very open and modular, right? I even when designing it for a single group to play, I built in a lot of decisions for them to make and directions that they could go that were totally different from each other that would affect the story greatly. And that would be the complicated part about doing campaigns, that I need to actually develop all the branches instead of, oh, they made this decision and went this way, I can stop developing that other way. I have to go back and develop all those other ways. That would be a lot more content writing for me, and that's why I haven't dedicated myself to that. I haven't started up a new Kickstarter for the campaign itself, because I know that would be, like, as much work as writing another novel, and I would actually kind of rather write a novel first.
Right.
So, because I have so many writing projects on the plate at once, it's hard to decide, like, what to put my mind into first. And with the success of Dragonline, I started thinking, well, maybe I'm a game designer, like a board game, card game designer, and didn't know it. So, maybe I should try to do more of that.
Well, and I do want to get to the Dragonline, but I think Caleb mm-hmm. also, because it's pretty much normal that I talk, like, 90% of the time, Caleb tries to get words in edgewise, and between you and I, poor Caleb is just sitting there. So, Caleb, what questions do you have for our guest tonight?
Oh, my question's going to go out to Teller of Penn and Teller and say, hey, buddy, what's going on? I think the two of us are having an awesome conversation right now. We're talking about magic and stage shows, and we're just letting you two and Penn just ramble on. This is awesome. This is nice. Great. Wow, this is it really is a pleasure to talk to you, CB. The stuff that I read over and looking at the stuff you've put online and some of the stuff you have out there for sale is quite interesting. It's really well put together. So I think it's great to talk to another person who like Michael and myself really kind of is focused on story and is kind of coming from that mindset of telling a story. Not necessarily writing a novel, of course you have done that successfully, but approaching the game from the story and kind of keeping that as a priority. So I'm a little bit curious here, completely tangential from the first chunks of conversation here. You touched real briefly on kind of your you've been a gamer and you've been interested in that kind of stuff. What kind of is your pedigree? I mean, where do you come to the table from? Did you start with D&D? Did you start with something older? Have you experimented with a bunch of different systems? I mean, what's your forte there when it comes to dice on the board?
Well, I've been a storyteller for a very long time, and my writing career sort of begins when I'm 6 years old writing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fan fiction. I don't know how publicly I should admit something like that, but I saw stories and my brain sort of naturally went to, I see how the story is constructed. Like, instead of enjoying the story, like a lot of kids would watch the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and be like, sweet turtles. But I was looking at it and I was like, oh, plot construction and characters and world building and like the pieces, I didn't have names for them yet. I wouldn't until college. But the pieces of the story were sort of separated out from me. And I was, without knowing it, I was watching television and reading books and watching movies and comic books and video games with a more sort of academic eye. And I would see the pieces of the story and how the pieces fit together and why the pieces worked the way they worked sort of from the outside. And I would take that and I would think, okay, well, I think these pieces would fit together better. And I learned later, you know, this is all about tropes and reconstruction and... Sorry.
Hold on, we'll pick that back up after that.
Yeah, sorry, I should have turned off my computer.
Well, no, that's just part of your personality. That's fine.
Yeah. So I would see how these pieces fit together, and I know now that it's about it's tropes and reconstruction and building off of other people's stories, and these weren't concepts that I knew yet, but that was what I was doing. And I did the same thing with games. What I was most into was world building. I was really interested in war and what I now would call setting development and understanding of the history and the backgrounds and the magic. Rules of fantasy and science fiction settings. And so I sort of came to it first as a world builder. And that was the same for me as a writer and as a gamer. My early memories of role-playing games were, I had a buddy that our big thing that we liked to do together, when we were like 7 years old and having sleepovers or whatever, is that we would sit up late into the night before we knew what D&D was. We'd never heard of TSR. We didn't know what role-playing was. But we would sit up late into the night and invent stories for each other to be the hero. And essentially, we were being player and DM. Just didn't know what that was. And so, I would create a world, and I would give him an objective, and we would go back, and we didn't have any dice and we didn't have any rules. We just told a story together. And my first exposure to real tabletop role playing, it was actually like books and dice and stuff. It's maybe 10 or 11 years old. I got into AD&D, and I hated it. I absolutely hated it, like the structure of it and the rules and everything. I don't know. It's looking back, it's possible I just had a bad DM.
Yeah.
But I despised what it represented as a storytelling mechanism. I preferred the loose sort of form, but I liked that the rules gave us a way to sort of establish and maintain more what would I now call verisimilitude. I'm gonna try to remember where I was. So I like the idea that the rules gave us the sort of verisimilitude and the sort of structure to the game, but I didn't like how it was done. And so I came up with my own system. I did a lot of experimental things. And through my teens and early 20s, I was subjecting my friends to campaign after campaign of experimental rules where I was constantly, and it was at the same time I was developing this Dark World setting. I was constantly coming up with new ways to resolve conflicts. I even had at one point another sort of embarrassing thing. It was half LARP almost, where, and I didn't, yeah, at the time I didn't know what live action role playing was, but I thought what would be cool would be to resolve combat with sort of turn-based movements, where when it was time to fight, I would stand up and play the part of the monster, and the player would stand up and play the part of the hero, and we would, like, one at a time make our strikes and blocks, and then I would have a sit-down and roll to see what that actually meant. And it was really convoluted, and it had all kinds of extraneous rules. It wasn't until I was in college that when 3.0 came out, and I tried it out with a couple of friends, and actually I decided it was okay. And so I switched over to it, and I started developing things with that, and then 3.5 and Pathfinder, where Isles of the Sun finally came out. And, you know, my writing as a novelist and as an attempted professional author was always sort of parallel to that, and I didn't really think of them as being something that worked together until I started thinking about, well, I could publish this story. You know, I've got the world building credentials and experience that I could do something more with this, and that's where Isles of the Sun was. Does that answer your question, Caleb?
Yes. And now I will exercise. The second best talent I have learned from being part of this show is to summarize all of that very quickly and briefly here.
Okay.
if I may, I think it's fair to say that, CB, you have approached your gaming career first and foremost with the importance of looking at the story and the world that you are playing in. And in the years playing, you kind of run the gamut of D&D from earliest to present day terms. You've liked parts of the system, you haven't liked other parts of the system, but you have not felt trapped by any restrictions of a system. You felt free and able to create your own rules and develop your own system, which really works very strongly hand in hand with your creative drives as being a storyteller.
That's pretty good, yeah.
There you go, see? I'm an expert at summing things up.
Right.
Well, that's because I'm an expert at rambling. He kind of had to be.
I would be too, but as a teacher, I usually have an hour for each concept I need to explain. So I've got, you know, my space filling talents are also an expert.
Now, jumping back specifically to editions, have you experimented with the 5th edition at all? Do you have any... you did any of the testing, or have you looked at the PHB?
I have not. I had applied for some of the testing at some point, and I don't even remember if they emailed me back about that, because I was so busy with other things at the time.
Sure.
And when it came out that, oh, here's the free to the public, the basic guide for the next version of D&D, I was like, yeah, I'll download that, and I downloaded it to my hard drive and haven't looked at it since. So, no, I haven't actually played with it yet. I've heard some good things about it,
okay.
But no, I don't know much about the D&D 5 beyond. And the two campaigns that I'm in now, one is a player and one is a DM, are both on Pathfinder, which I very much like.
Gotcha. Well, I think it would be safe to say that from our experience with 5th edition, fifth edition is pretty freeform. Mm-hmm. I don't want to call it rules light because a lot of people get upset when we use terms like that. But there is a lot of wiggle room within the rules, and I think that is done with the intention of letting people like yourself kind of run free with the storytelling side of it.
Mm.
And the rules are very flexible to make it fit however you would choose to run your story, whether you had new rules specifically or you just wanted to be a little bit more loose and from the hip with how certain things in the black and white text are interpreted. So I think if you ever have a second to actually play around with it, you'd probably like it a whole lot.
I will have to take the opportunity to do that.
Now, talking about running games, you said you're playing, you said you're running one. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you've done a lot of work with game creation over the years here. Strictly from a creation standpoint, when it comes to you running a game, do you sit down and write out a story? Do you develop a plot? Do you kind of come up with an outline and react to your players? Do you do a little more improv at the table and then create a story kind of in retrospect and frame it up for the next session? How do you approach running and creating the game?
The easy answer is that I combine all of those things when appropriate.
That's cheap. You can't. No.
But what it really comes down to, for me, usually, is because I have such a love of world building, the big thing I do for campaign design is create hooks. So I have this world that, you know, wherever I got, whether I made the world or if I'm using somebody else's world or whatever, I want to put conflict or potential conflict into the world. So I want to make this place, okay, there's some political strife over here, and there's like dragon attacks over there, and there's rebels assaulting a kingdom over here, and there's the emperor is about to die and he doesn't have any heirs, and there's like all these things going on in the world that are all hooks for the players. They're all places where characters could go and make a difference, and where the people of the setting need someone to go and make a difference and allow the players to decide where they want to make a difference. And then, of course, I have to react to that. But if I've made this, you know, over here there's a, you know, one of the things I did with Isles of the Sun is one of the points of conflict is a group of terrorists that are in one of the northern isles, in the Isles of the Lynx on the channel between the Isle of the Lynx and the Ebonwood is the Avengers of Xylo, who are the sort of descendants of the survivors of an attack from the Isle of the Ebon to the north. The Isle of the Ebon is inhabited by these sentient trees who lived for thousands of years and have fond memories that are very sort of peaceful people, but there was a misunderstanding a couple hundred years ago, and Xylo was attacked and destroyed by the Shea, who were the sort of the progenitors of the current Epon. And so these defenders of Xylo are trying to keep the Epon out of the northern territories of the Isle of the Lynx, but since they're trees, they can't really just be like shuffled off. Because they can't be transplanted, they can't be moved, so they are going to live there until they die, which could take hundreds of years. And so the defenders of Xylo are killing the trees, which is against the treaty that came about after the war was over. So they have, you know, I've give the players a place where they can go, okay, I sort of understand these guys, and if I'm going to go try to deal with this, I need to understand more about the situation.
So okay, all right. So to sum up and condense that, I think we could say that you approach a game, running a game, I should say, or creating the content for a game, kind of like a big idea map. And you have these points of content or topics scattered around on a big piece of paper, and you have a starting point for your players, and you let them learn some of these other points and learn how these points may branch and connect to each other through research, letting them kind of pick where the game goes, but you have kind of a larger overall knowledge of all these potential events and how they might work together.
Absolutely. And I think to like sum it down into a single phrase that's sort of my guiding, other than the game needs to be fun, should be everybody's, you know, sort of primary guiding thing, I would say my secondary guiding thing is interesting decisions. That, I think, is one of the most important parts of running a game like this. You know, as a DM, there's a lot of ways to approach how you want to run the game, what kind of DM you want. And the kind of DM I want to be is the kind of DM that presents the players with interesting decisions that you need to. It's not just about, you know, rolling the dice and fighting the monsters, but they need to make decisions that have real impact on the world and that are interesting in and of themselves and could go either way. Like, you're not doing it wrong if they make this other decision. That, I think, is the sort of crux of what makes tabletop role-playing games so cool and so fun, is the ability to make such interesting decisions with that sort of real.
Absolutely, absolutely. I agree with you there. And I think what you're talking about here as your approach to creating and running games harkens back to something Michael and I talked about a couple shows previously when we talked about what it really means to run a quote-unquote sandbox-style game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're using you as a real-life example here. What you described is really the core meaning when we say a sandbox game.
Right.
You're letting the player do everything. You're letting the player make the decisions, make those interesting decisions and choices.
Mm-hmm.
You're not limiting what they do or why they do it. You're just there to make it happen. You're there to facilitate it. You have in the back of your mind as the GM the potential outcomes, the potential events, the potential connections, even if you're making them up on the fly. You have this idea in the back of your head, and you're letting them manipulate it, you're letting them react or interact with it, and you're both evolving as you go along.
Right. But I think the hooks are fundamentals of that. Like, I think there's a lot of amateur DMs who want to do the sort of sandbox style because they've heard, you know, it's bad to be railsy, it's bad to force your players to do your story or whatever. But then they sort of, okay, here's the setting, go. And the players don't have, like, they don't have anything to latch onto. They don't have any place to go, and it ends up just being a dungeon crawl and monster fest with no plot, right? And I think that's the challenge. That's the balance challenge for a DM, is to give the game a plot, to give the game an overarching story that really feels, you know, epic and involved, and that the characters are having an impact on the world, without sort of forcing them to go the way you want them to go, right? And that can take a lot of work, so part of the balance is also figuring out how for you to do that without it totally consuming your life, because you can, I'm sure you can imagine, you can get into such detail in so many branches, but creating a story instead that adapts to the decisions they make, rather than needing to be completely reworked when they make different decisions than what you expected, is a big part of that. Like, as an example, in a previous campaign I ran, I had the characters, I had a very brash set of players who were running some very brash, overly wacky type characters, who were very sort of over the top and demanding and brazen, and so when they pulled into a dock and there was an embargo on that dock from another kingdom, and I wanted them to become fugitives. I thought it would be like a cool adventure for them to be fugitives across the landscape, trying to get the other side of the continent to get escape from the embargoed continent. And so I had these guards come onto the ship and demand that they, you know, put down their weapons and relinquish their goods and come you know, that they were under arrest for violating the embargo. And I was fully expecting these characters to be the same brazen and brash people that they had been the entire time who had been playing the campaign so far, and they totally didn't. They set down their weapons, and they gave everything up and allowed themselves to be arrested, and that was not what I had expected them to do at all. And so I changed the story. Like, I had to make a snap decision. What am I going to do? You know, I have to come up with a completely different story. But then I realized I don't actually need a completely different story for them. I can do the same story and just adapt it to what they just did. And so instead of them being, you know, reckless fugitives escaping across the countryside running from the constables, I made them constables themselves. When they were arrested and brought into the sheriff's office, the sheriff made them all deputies and told them that he had heard about their exploits and wanted them to represent his office across the continent and get to a particular representative over at the place where I originally expected them running to, and instead they were running from criminals. So really I just had to kind of change the names of a couple of things in the adventures that I had already planned for and didn't have to complete, but the story felt entirely different. And to the players, it was something that they had done. Like, they had made a big impact here by deciding to set down their weapons and use their weapons to fight the guards. But I didn't actually have to do any extra work because of that. And that's part of that sort of, but that's also part of work-life balance, you know, DM-life balance. But it was part of the balance of structure and story for that as well.
Cool. That is, that's a great way to run it, and I think that's a really good example. A very specific example of what it means to work with hooks and how to improv at the table and just keep everything fun. Obviously, your goal there is for everyone to have a good time, not force them to listen to a story. You're telling a story with them.
Right.
So let's trade spaces here. Let's go back to Michael. What's up with you over there, Michael?
What I would say about the example you just gave, CB, is a couple of concepts that we've talked about before is, one's the illusion of choice, that at the end of the day, your players got to where you wanted them to go, but they had the freedom to get there the way they wanted. And I think for some people, that illusion of choice is also kind of a dirty word, like, you know, plot. But at the end of the day, like I said, we, as DMs, we have to craft a story in one way or the other. If we don't, then we're just sitting around not doing anything, which isn't fun.
Mm-hmm.
So taking what they, and without invalidating the choices of the players. I mean, you could have just had the constables that arrested them be corrupt and literally force a fight where they had to defend themselves or die and force them to be the criminals that you wanted them to be, but that would have invalidated their choice. So by just saying, okay, you surrendered, that's fine, you know, snap decision, you make them constables, which is a very, you know, Wild West sort of situation with Wyatt Earp. You know, he's the famous lawman now. That that causes the same sort of complications, but it allows them the freedom to feel like this happened because we made those choices. So I do agree with Caleb. I think that's an excellent way to take what you've already created, but allow the players to have the influence that makes them feel connected to the story.
And that's part of the interesting choices, right? That's the choices that the players make are not interesting if they start to feel like they don't have an impact on the story. Even if they don't actually have an impact on the story, that's not the part that's important, because you don't say that to the players. And maybe my players will listen to this and they'll get very disappointed. But you don't actually tell the players, oh, you know, the decisions you make don't actually have an impact on the story, and whatever. They need to feel like they have an impact on the story, even if they're not creating extra work for them. And that's the sort of how to make the story work in such a way that they can do whatever they want to do and approach the problem however they want to do it without making it harder for you to be their DM. I think that's part of the interesting choices sort of mantra.
And I agree with you. Kind of going back to like a video game analogy that, you know, I like games like Mass Effect and Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, where you can play sort of the good side or the bad side. And at the end of the day, you're probably going to get to the same place. Mm-hmm. But I'll go back and I'll play that game multiple times because there are certain decision points that I want to see how it plays out if I right. make a choice. And I like what you're saying, that as a DM, I would like for my players to go back and go, wow, you know, if we had questioned that guy rather than killing him, how would this game have been different? And if you're giving them those types of decision points where they do wonder how the game would have been different, I think then you're doing a good job setting up those interesting decisions rather than just forcing them along a preset story. So, I would give you high marks for that. So I do want to move into your game, because one of the things that you said early on that I thought was interesting is this game has been probably more successful than some other projects that you've worked on, and you said you've almost been surprised yourself at its success, but it wasn't even something that you had intended to create necessarily. It was part of a stretch goal.
Right.
So other than like campaigns, you're not really a game designer, or do you have a background in game design? Because I'm just interested in how you went from, oh, this will be a cool thing to add to my Kickstarter, to a successful, you know, two-player strategy game that's doing very well for you.
Well, I've always been a sort of hobbyist in game theory, and as a video gamer and a board gamer, I have a big collection of board games that I don't get to play nearly as often as I'd like to. I've always been very interested in balance and tactics, and I've read a lot up on sort of game theory, even like the sort of mathematical academic style of game theory stuff, like the stuff they pretend to talk about on those numbers detective TV shows. Reading about things like the math and the balance and the psychology of how people play games and what it sort of means inside their heads when they're making these decisions. And when I was approaching Dragonline, so what Dragonline comes from is in the Isles of the Sun, there's a game that the characters can play called Dragonline, which was at first an improvised thing. One of my characters was in town in a shop somewhere, and one of the random things that I'd rolled up on the chart of what's for sale in the shop was a deck of cards, and the player decided to investigate that. They latched onto that and asked more about it. So, what are these cards? Are these like the playing cards that I know of? And I said, no, this is a collectible card game. I just made up a name called Dragonline. This is a collectible card game called Dragonline that like the kids and sailors like to play. This is a starter deck for that. I was sort of thinking about it like a Magic the Gathering type game. And I was expecting it to be a sort of throwaway improvisation, but this player latched onto that idea and wanted to play it. He got really excited. Oh, I want to play it out. And he bought the starter deck, and he went out to like a pub, and he tried to find other people who played. And I was frantic for how I could actually make this work in the game. And it came down to I've changed it a couple of times since. If you look in the Isles of the Sun rule book, the rules of how the characters in the Isles of the Sun setting can play Dragonline, but it doesn't actually talk about really what Dragonline is, other than that it's a collectible card game. And so you're like, when you play, you roll up, you know, a sense motive check, and then a bluff check, and diplomacy check, and then whoever got the highest numbers wins, basically. And that represents the game for the characters, but the players don't really have any game to play. They're just rolling. So this was so then out of that was the sort of spur of the moment thing, and that same player, when I was coming up with the Kickstarter, said, you know what you should do as a stretch goal? You should make a real Dragonline, because that was cool. I was like, all right. So I put it in there, and when it succeeded, as you know, as I was saying before, I was almost horrified. Like, well, what am I gonna do? I don't know how to make a card game. But so I just fell back on the way I DM, right? I was thinking, okay, well, what's important in the game? Tactics, balance, and interesting decisions. Those are the things that I think are important. And I had already established in the lore that it was a two-player only game. So I thought, okay, well, what would be interesting? And I ended up combining elements of Magic the Gathering. You can see sort of in there that like each of the cards has slightly different abilities and different numbers that work with them, but they're simpler to understand. And it's not a collectible card game, it's a 35 card deck that's static, and both players play from the same deck. So it's not exactly like the, because I didn't think I would be able to make a collectible card game, that sounded wasteful. So the players are playing from the same 35 card deck, and each dragon has different abilities and different numbers and what have you, and they line them up and they fight, and it's all math and dragon selection and tactical. There's no dice, there's no drawing of random cards except for at the very beginning, and the selection of which dragons go into which army is done with a draft rather than a random draw. So the players have equal chance to get the good dragons that they want for their army each time. So I put all these elements together to create something that I thought was, you know, as balanced and tactical as possible while giving the players interesting decisions. So the interesting decisions come in the draft, and tactics come in the layout of the army, and the balance comes in the single deck, the simple abilities that the dragons have. And that was the concept. And so I just made up some numbers for the cards to have, and I put some simple art that I made in my MS Paint. And I sent the game to a bunch of friends to, like, print out and try. And they had serious balance issues, and I had to rework a bunch of numbers. We went through 5 or 6 iterations of trying different numbers just to try to make a game that actually at least felt like a game, more than, you know, to satisfy my Kickstarter backers, more than anything else. But when it was done, and I finally figured out the final tweak that it needed to really feel balanced and interesting, which was in this case, if you take a look at the Dragonline cards, you'll notice that they have sort of inverse power. The dragons that have higher life to get lower attack, and dragons that have higher attack to have lower life. That was not true in the original iterations of the game. I had sort of tried to represent the rarities of the cards, sort of like magic cards, by making some of them fundamentally better than others.
Right.
And that turned out to be a mistake, because then it removed the interesting decisions. Because then the decision was, oh, well, I'm taking the more powerful card for my money. So I tried to make the last few iterations came after trying to make the dragons all about the same power. So there's no dragon in a 35-card deck that is fundamentally better than any other dragon. So you really do have to decide which dragon you want for your tactic. And that, finally, when I sent out that version, I got back all the feedback from all the players. Okay, now you have something. Now this is something interesting. And after a few more tweaks of numbers and abilities, especially with the ice dragon, the self-destruct dragon, that's a really high cost for his attack, that he destroys himself as well, and tweaking how that worked and when it would work well. It's a challenging dragon to work into your tactics, and so that took a lot of tweaks. But I think we really ended up with something that was interesting, balanced. And so I started taking it to shows, and the first show I took it to was this CincyCon, which is a tabletop game nerds convention. And I just had my little card game. You know, there are a whole bunch of people playing, like, Warhammer 40K, and I don't know, I'm not really into the... If you need a measuring tape and a laser level to play, I don't play. So that's like that whole... That was what 90% of the people were there to play. And so I wasn't really into that demographic. But I had my little tactical card game off to the side, and everybody who walked by was like, hey, you want to try my game? And loved it. Everybody loved it so much that I knew I had something, you know, really great. And I even, since then, now there's a deluxe edition of Dragonline, which instead of just cards, it comes with a bunch of counters and physical pieces and stuff to make it sort of be more swaggy. Because that was a lot of the feedback I got from the public who was playing. I want some real pieces to hold my hand to make it feel more like a board game and less like a card game. So I have a deluxe edition of that now. But I still have, and then my most recent show I went to Comic-Con, which I wasn't sure because there were no other gaming people there. There were no other board games or card games at Comic-Con. It was actually, looking back, I'm kind of surprised that they accepted me into the show because it is a juried show. They look at what you have and decide whether or not you fit. Everybody else there was very comics. They were very superheroes and art and graphic novels and that kind of stuff. And I was there with my sci-fi book and my card game. And I totally did not feel like I fit in at all with anybody at Comic-Con. But, you know, it interested people. I had, you know, people come by like, oh, what is this? and I had one of the artists, Amanda Troutman, who did the cover art for the Isles of the Sun guide, as well as a bunch of the internal art, who's also a close friend of mine. She was there at the show with me, and so people were talking to her and watching her do some artwork, and that kind of draws me through, because of course the show is about comics and comics art. But then again, I had some people, since it was Comic-Con, who would sit down and they'd start playing the game, and you'd get halfway through and they're like, oh, this is like a real game. Like, I don't know what they were expecting, but they were like, I don't know. but when actual gamers would stop by, you know, they would see it and they'd be like, oh yeah, I play games, let me try. And they would think, everybody plays this game. So I'm really surprised, and I'm proud of it. Like, it feels kind of almost kind of arrogant to say, like, oh, I'm really proud of myself for making this game. But that's not really how I feel about it. Like, I'm proud of the game. Like, I made this thing and I sort of sent it into the world like my child, and it's doing really well, and I'm just watching it do that without really feeling responsible for it.
You could go the Munchkin route and have like a superhero version for Comic-Con. You could have a zombie version for the zombie cons. Just basically the same exact game, just put a zombie on one card and dragon on the other and call it like Zombie Line.
It would require hiring more artists.
Oh, yes, that's true, and you've had trouble with that.
Yeah. But that is a good point. I could theme it to something other than dragons, and it would be the same game.
Same as that game, just like Munchkin, which I like Munchkin. I'm not blasting it, but you can get a Munchkin for every conceivable concept and theme these days. I'm pretty sure there's a My Little Pony Munchkin.
And I hear ponies are hot right now.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. So let's throw this out there. If someone wants to try Dragonline, can they get a hold of a copy? I know you sent me a print and play version. Is there a way for them to purchase this? Is there a physical product they can buy?
Yeah, you can pick it up on Amazon. If you just search for Dragonline, you'll find it on there. It's not on my author page. The Isles of the Sun is on my author page because it's a book, but you can't put non-book items on your author page. So that's the one thing. The one thing I have out there on Amazon, it's not on my author's page, Dragonline. Search for that stuff. So it is on Amazon there. It's also on GameCrafter, who's the publisher of the game. You can buy it directly from them, which is just GameCrafter.com, I think. And they also have the print and play version. If you want to pick up the print and play, if you have a nice printer and some cardstock and want to just print it out yourself, which is significantly less expensive, you can pick that up from GameCrafter as well. And they also have the deluxe edition there. The deluxe edition is not on Amazon yet, but that's I have some paperwork that I have to get on there. But then as soon as I do that, it'll be ready. Hopefully by the time your podcast goes out, the Dragonline Deluxe will also be available on Amazon. Everything can also be found on the Mana Wafer Studios website, which is manawafer.com, also has links to all of the places where you can pick up the Mana Wafer stuff. Mana Wafer Studio is the name I basically gave to all of my publishing projects. When I did The Isles of the Sun, I needed a sort of umbrella for things that I was planning on doing independently, so Mana Wafer Studio is that. And we're also working on if any of your audience are both poets and video gamers, we're currently collecting submissions for Dangerous to Go Alone, which is a video game and video game culture collection of poetry. We're accepting and searching for submissions for that book now.
So Dragonline's doing very well. Any idea, maybe an expansion? You know, that seems to be the thing now. Add in a new type of dragon that changes up the math, or are you looking at doing something new?
I have thought about releasing like here's another type of dragon. Since the game is divided into five suits of dragons right now, with seven dragons apiece, and releasing another pack with just seven more cards. That's here's one more type of dragon to put into the deck. I think would work, but you know, I would want to be really careful about that because, you know, I mentioned I'm an avid board gamer myself. I have lots and lots of board games in my basement where we play our board games. And I have a lot of expansions for those board games that I do not play because the original game was really good, and the expansion didn't really expand the game. It just added to it. And that's... I want to be careful not to do that. And so I'm putting thought into what that new dragon might be that would work and not overbalance and not overcomplicate. And I've gotten a lot of suggestions from people, and a lot of fans of the game have written to me or come up to me at shows and said, oh, I have an idea for a new dragon you could put in. So I have, no shortage of ideas for dragons, but thinking about what would actually work well and what people would actually want to play. I don't want it to just expand. I don't want it to just add to the game. I want it to improve the game. I want it to be something that people say, ooh, this makes the game better, right? Rather than just bigger. And that's really important to me. I don't want to do an expansion to find that perfect thing. I might never, right? I mean, Dragonline might be just this fluke that I designed one game.
Well, you're batting 1,000 to use the sports analogy.
Right, I get quit while I'm ahead. Right now, I'm a game designer who's always made good games every game. But I'm also thinking of doing another type. Since I had the success with Dragonline, I think, well, what if I take my philosophy that I used to design Dragonline, make it good? Can I apply that to something else? Can I make something different? And so I'm thinking about, I could theme it in Dark World again, right? Put it in the same sort of file as the sun, maybe one of the other areas of Dark World, and make it a balanced, tactical, interesting decision game for more than two players. Maybe a sort of area conquest game, like a Risk or something, but without a whole bunch of dice and random things, but more tactics. And so, whether I expand Dragonline or try to develop a new game that works like Dragonline with the same philosophies as Dragonline. Partly, I'm scared that if I try to design another game, it's not going to be good.
Right.
So, and I recognize that. I see that this is why I'm not hesitating. But at the same time, like I mentioned before, all the projects on the next thing I really want to do that I'm super excited about is to write a new novel that's set in the Isles of the Sun world that would essentially be a sort of prequel to the world the players would be in. So the players are starting it out the exact year that the setting book takes place is escaping. But the novel would take place 200 years before. A sort of explaining about the world and introducing some of the legendary figures that are just parts of the lore and legend and artifacts of the campaign become actual characters. But I don't want it to feel like a book set in a D&D setting, if that makes sense. Right?
It does.
and that's why I'm sort of thinking of going into the past of the world instead of the present, because I don't want it to have that exact same feel as the setting that I developed for play. This is a setting for story, so it's a slightly different place and time than the setting that ties in and explains and does all the things that a good prequel should do, hopefully.
Right.
So that's probably the next big thing that I think is that. But at the same time, it's the bane of any artist. While I'm thinking about that and really excited about it, I'm always ooh, but I also really want to do my campaign and I really want to design this other board game I also want to go look at those butterflies. So, and of course, I'm teaching at the same time.
Well, you could just play D&D in your classroom and call it research. You could have them play test your games for you. I'm sure you could work that out somehow.
Yeah, I'm sure they would. Although most of my students are nurses, and they, when I try to talk to them about my games, I just get blank stares. Is it cribbage? No, I don't. I can't even talk to you. Is it Monopoly? No, I told you I'm not talking to you. So it's not. I'm sure how you guys are into board games as well as role-playing games, but I get that. Anytime I tell somebody I'm into board games, especially my students, the very first thing they say is, do you like Monopoly? And I know, instantly, I can't talk to this person about it because they just don't. They've been corrupted by the Milton Bradley machine. They don't really know anything about gaming, they know social activities in which you roll dice and use pawns. They don't actually, and that's where my students are. And it's not to, you know, to demean them. It's not, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's my population of students in my classroom is not the same as the audience for my games and books.
Gotcha. Well, I think we're going to need to wrap up here pretty quick, but I do want to ask, since you are a board game person, do you have a favorite or a couple favorites? You know, just like if you're going to try to teach someone who's not yet corrupted by Milton Bradley, what is your go-to gateway drug board game?
Well, that's two different answers.
Okay.
The typical sort of gateway game, I would go with either Catan or Carcassonne, depending upon the person they are. But that's only because those games are such good introductions to the sort of European tactical style game without being so different from what, you know, corrupted people think gaming is, that they don't understand it, right? Because there's still dice and there's still pawns and there's the, you know, they can sort of, and there's still like economic and trading and stuff like that. Especially with Catan, and Carcassonne is so straightforward with sort of tile placements and matching. It's like making a jigsaw puzzle, except you're getting points. And so those two games particularly, and one of the reasons they're so popular is because they're such good gateway games, and they're such good representations of what it means to be a good game. But as far as like my favorite game to play when I get to go with my friends, I really enjoy History of the World, which is a 7-player epic-based conquering game. Small World is a similar game that you spend more time on because it doesn't take 12 hours to play like History of the World does. It only takes a couple hours to play because it's, you know, it's time limits and it's much smaller. I play with my wife. We play a lot of Ticket to Ride, which she loves that game, and so when she's playing, but one of my favorites that I don't always get to play is Nexus Ops, which is a little bit of an obscure game. It's still area control, and there is a lot of dice on Barney games, like some of my crowd isn't too fond of it. But I really like the mechanics. It's an area control game with a randomized board, a small randomized board, and the players have secret orders for what they are trying to accomplish on the board. So it's not just necessarily, oh, I'm trying to take over the board and use as much territory as possible. Like, well, I'm creating tools. So it's, I have a set of cards in my hand that are telling me what to do. I have a general somewhere who's giving me orders, and these are those orders, and I need to carry them out and points in order to win the game. So there's conflict, and there's area control, and there's tactics, which is what I like about the other games. But it doesn't have the sort of aggression that games like Risk and History of the World and even Small World to an extent can bring out. Because you're like, in those games, you're looking at alliances and you're making friends and breaking friendships and betraying people. Whereas in Nexus Ops, it's just, well, these were my orders. I attacked you. I needed to get that thing and do this stuff, and it was on my card, so I get the points. And there's very little animosity. So it has the tactics and the balance and the very cool stuff that I like about the games, but it doesn't have the sort of meanness that a lot of those games end up having. And I think if I were to design an area control game, I would go for that same sort of, I'd try not to copy Nexus Ops as much as I could, but I would want that same sort of feel that it were conquering, but we're being nice about it.
Right.
And okay. We're not trying to strangle each other. We're just trying to, you know, be there first.
Right. Now, I get that a lot. Like when I've played Risk, there's always that guy, and sometimes you're that guy, who just has to start. You know, it's like, okay, we're all kind of doing our thing. I'm going to destroy you now. I'm sorry, and you're out of the game. And, you know, there is that moment like, why me? Why didn't you go that way?
Exactly. The worst is diplomacy. Have you played diplomacy?
I have not. I've heard a lot about it, but I've not actually played it.
It is the only way to move ahead in that game is to make everyone think that they're your friends, but only actually be friends with half of them, but not actually friends with them. In fact, you're switching. So it's like the point of the game is to trick people into alliance.
Yeah, that's not a friendship ruiner.
And that's the only way to win. that game is awful. I know so many people who love it, and I think, like, this is the epitome of, like, game theory. And when you look at it from, an academic game theory perspective, it is sort of, like, Prisoner's Dilemma era stuff, but it is really bad for, like, people who like each other and want to continue to like each other.
Right.
So, in any game that I would design, I would try to avoid that as much as possible.
Fair enough. Well, I think we're about ready to go. We have our closer, though. We can't let you get away without asking this last question. So, Caleb, do you want to close us out?
Sure, absolutely. All right, CB. We have had a pretty good conversation here. All kinds of great stuff we've covered here. Lots of good information. We're definitely going to have links in the show notes and the websites to yourself and your variety of products. So, I'm going to encourage everyone to swing over and check those out. We always end our interviews with the RPG Academy closer question. So directed to you here, CB, what is one piece of advice that you would choose to share with a brand new player or game master?
I feel like I could just go back on my interesting decisions advice, but that might be too easy. I guess the big thing that I would say to someone new getting into DMing for the first time, and they've got all these books, and they've got players are waiting on them, and they think them and they do so much, is it doesn't have to be a lot of work, and it needs to be fun for you too. And you don't want to sacrifice the fun of the game for anyone, for the players or for yourself, in the name of the rules. And if you find rules that are making the game less fun, or even just making it kind of annoying or making it drag because you have to look them up all the time, get rid of them. Just tell the players, all right, this is getting old. We're not going to use this rule anymore. Move on.
I think that's good advice. Don't let the rules get in the way of having fun.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Well, CB, I do appreciate your time tonight. Appreciate you spending some time with us and the advice you've given, and I have not got to play Dragonline. I do have the print and play version you gave me, and it's something I do want to try. And so here in the near future, I plan on playing it, and maybe I can put up a review on the website separately to this. You can give us feedback and comments on our website, therpgacademy.com. You can listen to previous podcasts on our website and subscribe to new ones on iTunes. If you have a suggestion for a table topic, we'd love to hear it. Email us at podcast@therpgacademy.com or connect with us. We're on Twitter @therpgacademy. We're on Facebook @facebook.com/therpgacademy. We also have a Google Plus page, The RPG Academy. As always, thanks for listening, and remember, if you're having fun, you're doing it right.